And thus, recreation is introduced, the idea, right? Good morning, good to see you. Sorry about my voice. I've been working on it for about 30 hours, and this is as good as it gets. So hang on, they'll turn the volume up. The best part, I think, is when, but you can't capture the whole movie. Or maybe we can. Maybe that's what we'll do next week. We'll watch the whole Griswold movie. He takes a BB gun and holds the guy hostage. And then they argue over whether it can actually penetrate the skin and leave a nasty infection. I just think it's awesome. Grab your notes. Turn to session chapter 5, number 5. Talking about work, and I'm going to give you some definitions again. But here's what we recognize is that work is a big deal. There's no way around it. Last week, I was with my wife in a store, and we were talking. And she said something, I said something. Couple minutes later, she said something, I said something. Couple minutes later, she said something, I said something. And then she looked at me, she goes, "You're being short with me." And I said, "Huh, that's interesting." And so I thought about it for a minute, and then I came back and I was like, "You know what? I am being short with you, and I'm sorry." She goes, "Why are you being short?" I was like, "I don't know." So I thought about it a few more minutes, and I said, "Okay, here's why I'm being short. Is that I got four or five things at work, this, and this, that are loose ends. I'm good to have two loose ends. Maybe even three, but four, five, six loose ends is a little bit disconcerting for me. And so I'm on edge and I'm a little frustrated and I'm not even realizing how that's manifesting itself in my relationships with my wife and my home. And so it's helpful to even acknowledge some of the tensions that we manage and to know yourself well enough to be able to discern some of that. And it is interesting that you don't automatically at the end of a day drive home and just take whatever has happened and set it in the passenger seat of your car, get out, go enjoy your time with your family, get back in the next morning and go, "Oh, there you are, pick it up again." That's not how we're wired up. So since that's not how we're wired, then we have to make some choices. We have to make some decisions. We have to be able to think through some things. So let me give you our categories again. And I think the slide will come up again. We talk about work. We're talking about work energy that is expended. We talk about rest, which we'll do next week. Energy recovered. When we talk about recreation, we're talking about energy diverted. I'm going to unpack that in a few minutes. And then escape, which Jim Taylor talked about, energy corrupted. All right. We're actually going to do two things. I'm going to give a few minutes to the idea of recreation. This is not a complicated idea, but it is a little bit nuanced. And so it goes in tandem with next week. But I'm going to roll it out in a few minutes. And then I want to speak to kind of our thinking about work and the next generation. All right. So I want to split our time. All right, so we talk about recreation, we're talking about energy diverted. I use the word diverted, it's an English word that the English primarily use. Well, I found it in Mary Poppins. You got to remember, I got four daughters. I know more about Disney than you will ever know, all of you put together. I know more about the history of the princesses and what they do and don't do, the way they feel, what they believe, right? So anyway, Mary Poppins, when she gets her job and she's interviewing, she holds up the review that was written by the children, and it says, "Play games all sorts." And she says, "I think you'll find my games most," what? "Diverting." It's a cool English word that this would be, that the games actually divert your attention and your energy away from what? From your work. Diversion. And we don't even, psychologists don't understand this, but we know it's true, is that diversion away from something does not mean that there's still not activity happening in the area where you've been diverted away from. Is that when our attention moves away, there's still things going on over here. Emotionally, physically, mentally, there's still repair going on. Let me show you this slide of this dam. We have a dam that is bursting, right? And this is created, right? But if that's going to be fixed, the river behind it, the pressure behind it will have to be diverted away so that significant repairs can happen. And you will see engineers, they will redirect or divert a river away from an electric plant or away from a dam so that significant repairs can be made. And so what has to happen in our lives is there has to be a diversion of energy away from work. It is still the movement of energy, but there has to be a diversion away so that the repair can come to you mentally, emotionally, physically, to your heart, to your soul. Repair can happen. Now, you don't have to do that repair. It'll just happen. It's the beauty of how God created us. When you genuinely recreate, magical things happen in your heart over here. So let me give you a couple categories for not rest, which is ceasing. All right? Now see, rest primarily, we're going to, under this model, we're going to say rest is sleep. Okay? Now we'll expand a little more on that. Recreation and rest are not the same. Rest is the ceasing of energy, the recovering of energy. Recreation, recreating, is you're still putting energy out, just in a different direction. Legitimate recreation. The first idea is low impact. All right? Low impact is this. It is stepping away from what you do and stepping down in pressure and energy. It is stepping away and stepping down. So it's easy. So it might be a walk. It might be a hike. It might be reading. For some of you crazy people, it might be golf, which for me is a way to increase energy. I love throwing clubs. I mean, it's fine. It's good. It works out my arms. So fishing. You go, fishing is rest. No, fishing is recreating, if that's something you enjoy doing. No two people have the same cocktail of recreation. Fishing, hunting. Some of you, shopping. Sex, we'll put it in the rest and recreation category. Make sure we have it covered. Give you two that are opposite each other, but they're both fall in the category depending on your personality. Solitude and community. So for some of you, if you're introverted, you gain energy by solitude, by being alone. That's where you gain energy, right? For some of us, the other half, you gain energy by being with people in community. Now, let me divide community into real community or hanging out. Hanging out is eating wings, watching the game with somebody. That's great. That's fine. You got to do some of that. That's not really community. Community will be looking at someone face to face, listening to their story, interacting with their story, telling them your story. That'd be community. Both are needed, right? So solitude, community, hanging out. Tearing apart your garage, getting everything out onto the driveway, putting it all back, organized, taking a load to the dump. For some of you, that's therapy. It's recreation. You feel good when you're done, right? I hear folks in our church say all the time, love to cut grass. Cutting grass is therapeutic. Like, no, that's why I had a son. I begged and pleaded God, give me a son, right? So now that's all working good for me. But planting trees, right? Planting, I love, go to the nursery, get a lesson on what's going to go where and how it's going to look and what it's going to be and load that up, bring it home, dig holes. I mean, gosh, love that, right? So it's going to be different for everybody. Let me give you some high impact categories, ideas. Low impact, step away and step down. High impact, step away and step up in energy, right? High impact, step up in energy. So some of you, we got folks in our church around the community who love to mountain bike, love to climb mountains. Sometimes they climb mountains with ropes. Sometimes they climb mountains without ropes. We have triathletes. We have folks who run marathons, right? You run, race, you keep your time. We have some folks who will build their own house while they work a job or build a garage out back. Okay, that is very, building a house, very stressful. But it's not their job, and they find it very therapeutic. But here's the thing, the intensity of it, the intensity of training for a marathon, the intensity of building a house, it's different than what you do for work, but it is stressful. It is difficult, either physically, mentally, emotionally. That's a good thing, right? It's a diversion. You will have a cocktail of things that you do that are low impact, high impact, that you do that recreates your soul, then yours will be different than everybody else. And for me, it'll be a combination of walking, riding a bike, connecting with my wife. I'll play basketball one day a week. I used to play basketball 3 days a week, and then I got older, play basketball 2 days a week. Now I'm down to 1 day a week, right? Because just too miserable to play 2 days a week. Just takes too long to recover. So, but that's fine. And on the way over, on the drive over, every Wednesday, I think, why do I do this? This is miserable. This takes more energy than I have. The guys I play with are real competitive. I don't have enough testosterone anymore to keep up. I'm not angry enough to play this game anymore. I'm not competitive. And once you get in the flow, then they hit you in the face, and now you're angry and you're competitive. So I'm good, right? But every week I drive home and I think, okay, that was the right thing to do. For you, you got to study, for my world, you got to study, study, study. You're in meetings, meetings, meetings. And to be able to do something that amps the energy up is part of recreating. Now, I can't do that every day. So there's low impact things throughout the week. There's a couple high impact things throughout the week. I will say this. I met with a couple of psychologists a month ago. And here's what they said. They said that when it comes to relieving stress, not weight loss, okay, not weight loss. When it comes to relieving stress, 3 workouts a week where your heart rate is up for 25 to 30 minutes is what you need for physical, mental, emotional health when we're talking about relieving stress, all right? I said, 3. He goes, 3. He goes, not 4, not 5. He goes, you go to 4, wasting your time. He goes, we get no measurable benefit out of going to a 4th time. I was like, okay, so that's helpful. But 3, so there's going to be some high impact. There's going to be some low impact. But here is the litmus test. Ready? The litmus test of good recreation is that it makes you be ready to go back to work. If you are not ready to go back to work when you are done, you most likely have escaped. Okay? That's most likely what you did. The litmus test is that if at the end of your, you know, if your mind's not clear at the end of your workout, high impact, low impact, and whatever the cycle is you work through, it should make you want to go back to work. That you should, your mind should be clear, your heart should be clear. Let me give you some ideas to consider. And that really is one of them, but let me give you a few more. From the time I was 28 to 38, and it's still a fast-paced life. I have 3 teenagers, so it still moves very quickly. But from 28 to 38, we had 4 kids in 6 years. We had a church that was going from a couple hundred to a couple thousand. All right? You're so in it, you could not see the seismic shifts that were happening. You were just surviving day to day, right? Get up, do it, go to bed, do it, get up. You know, it's just, it's all that. If I could go back and argue with myself, and this would be a tough argument because I can be stubborn, is I would make the case that I need to create a couple spots, a few spots a week to do a better job recreating. The argument that I back then would make with me now would be, look at all the hours in the week. I've got to be as productive as I can be over here and over here. I cannot pull 3 hours out a week to go do these other things. But the argument I would make now against that me would be that, right, for that hour or that 40 minutes while you are recreating, it is true, you are not productive in that moment. But if we look at the total 168 hours of the week and we measure the productivity over the whole week with a few spots of recreating throughout the week, the grand total of production will go up through the course of the week. The quality of what you produce will go up and the creativity of what you produce will go up. Now, it's an argument, and it's debatable, it's arguable, but I'm just saying, that's the argument that I would make, and it's the argument that I am making. Now, I'm not advocating, we're advocating work really, really hard. Is that God creates to work 6 days and rest 1. And that the idea of recreating has to be a part of the mix. It cannot be your obsession and you go into passivity. It is recreating is the balance to make work better. It serves work. Okay? We don't serve recreation. We don't clamor for it. We don't crave it. It's that it serves work and enables us to work better. So that's what I think is the proper perspective. I think you have to come up with what is the daily and weekly and monthly routine for you. What kind of cycle are you on that you have to equip yourself for, that you have to prepare yourself for, that you have to allocate time for? Right? So like for me, I'm on a weekly cycle. The pinnacle of my week, oddly enough, is at 4:30 on Saturday afternoons. Like most of you are at the height of your relaxed state of the week. You are headed to a football game, coming back from a football game, taking a nap. You're engaged in some kind of family function. At 4:30, 5 o'clock on Saturdays is the peak. Because we are getting a recording of a sermon that will go to 4 campuses on Sunday morning. And so as best I can, I have to be ready for that moment. And then that carries over into Sunday. We'll speak two more times on Sunday. So then recovery for me, mentally, physically, and emotionally, starts Sunday afternoon. There's a routine that I have to work through Sunday to start Sunday afternoon, because on Monday, it starts all over again. And people are like, well, I mean, I'm tired from last week. No one cares about that. Well, I taught 4 weeks in a row. No one cares about that. They only care that next week you show up and you do your job like they do their job, right? So I have to work through a cycle of how do I mentally get clear, emotionally get clear, physically get ready to teach for that next weekend. And so that involves a process on Monday, a process on Tuesday, part of Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. All that works together for me. And it does the same thing for you. You have a regimen that weighs on you that you have to be ready for and prepared for. Let me give you a couple thoughts about under ideas for your day off. Your day off, first of all, you need some time off in a week, right? Work six. These are just ideas for you to think about. Work six, rest one. But recreation, whether it's through the week or a day off, is a discipline. And this is something we started early. I worked 18 months to start planning a church, and my wife looked at me one day. She goes, hey, are you going to start taking a day off sometime? And I grew up in an entrepreneurial home, and that it just worked a little differently, and I had no idea. So I called other churches and found out how it worked. And so since about 18 months into our church, we always had a day off. And my kids can tell you, on Fridays at lunch, what will you be doing? We'll be eating together as a family at some restaurant here in Greenville. Because Friday's a day off for me. So we are always... And there's a part of me that thought for years, look at what I'm doing for my family. But now looking back after a decade or so, I realized that that discipline of that time away recreating is healthy, not just for them, but for me. It builds our family, but it also heals me. I think another idea you got to deal with around your day off and at nights is how do you deal with your phone and your email? What do you do with being constantly on? There have to be some moments where you are not on, where you are off. Vacation. A couple ideas about that. You cannot fix the abuse of a whole year in 1 week of vacation. All right? It cannot be done. I have studied it. I have tested it. I've met with other people, and I have tried it. You can't do it. So anything that you do to yourself abusively for a year, you will have to undo for a year. Those things are, they're mirror images, okay? So there's no, I'm going to kill myself, and then I'm going to go away with my family for a vacation for a week, and everything's going to, that's where I'll get better. That's where I'll rest. No, because vacation with family is not about rest, right? There ain't nothing restful about it. And your kids and your family are looking at you, to supply energy for you to go do something that is fun. Diverting energy, recreating, takes energy. It is not the same as rest where you're ceasing and recovering energy. Recreation is an expenditure of energy just in a different direction. So you have to think, you have to plan, you have to research, you have to call and schedule, you have to get reservations, you have to pay money, you have to go do it, right? So it does cost you something. You have to work at it a little bit. So a 1 week's vacation cannot fix a year of abuse. What you do that's abusive throughout the year, you have to balance that throughout the year to restore that. And so for us, there'll come a time, usually every year, where we will, I try to build in different things throughout the year, but to be able to escape, and that's not a good word, to be able to move away from this environment with my wife, we go to Waynesville, someplace like that, where no, we don't know anybody, no one knows us. I walk around in a shop with her for 15 minutes. Then I go outside and sit on a bench. Stare at the street. It's awesome, right? I come out. She's like, hey, you doing all right? I was like, Mom, doing great. Keep shopping, right? Go eat a good meal. I mean, I'm brainless. Don't think about anything. Phone's lighting up. Just leave it in the car. I just leave it in the car. Just not even, not until, I'm not dealing with any of that right now. There have to be some spaces where you create some distance. There is a fine line between relaxing, recreating, and escaping. Once again, what's the litmus test? At the end of the 3-hour football game, you are not ready of watching on TV. you are not ready to go back to work because you were not really recreating or relaxing. You were actually escaping. You were numbing. And when you numb, you're not re-energized and ready to go execute. Diverting energy, healing your soul, expending some energy actually does work on your soul when you're not looking. And so we are balancing energy, right? In my house, we have two water heaters, one on one side of the house, one on the other. Someone's always staying with us. A couple weeks ago at a student retreat, we had 14 teenage girls staying in our house. So we're having to balance the showers because these tanks are depleting, right? It's like, I think we got one more over here, no more over there. Just wait a little bit. Because we got this depleting and it has to be brought back up. And then we're balancing between the two. You have different reservoirs of energy that are constantly being depleted and you're having to refill those. And it is no one else's responsibility to refill those but you. All right? All right. Enough of that. Next idea about our children and our work. How do we affect the next generation? Let me give you three categories of language that we talk in, that we speak around. First one is establishing authority. We talk about this 0 to 8 years old, round ideas. Can't go before 0, might stretch it beyond 8. I guess you could yell at them in the womb. Second idea. Develop responsibility, 7 to 13. Facilitate a healthy independence, 12 to 18. For our purposes, we want to focus on developing responsibility. This is around 6, 7, 8 to 12, 13 years old, right? Here's some big ideas, and I'll get to the real point. It is our responsibility as parents, and dads, you as dads, to teach your children about work. Which is not just a lecture. In fact, it doesn't involve hardly any lecture. There's no need to explain anything. It is on the job kind of training, right? And then you back that up. You backfill with words and explain what's going on as you're doing it. And so we want to teach them that work is a good thing. That just because it's hard doesn't make it a bad thing. Doesn't make it something to avoid. The fact that it's hard is, we're going to explain the curse and why that is. But that work is a good thing. And being productive is a good thing, and creating and cultivating and building and fixing, all of those are good things, and we need to embrace it, not avoid it. We find that last summer we had 24, 25 interns for the summer who are college students. we'll have 10 to 20, you know, on any given summer. Here's what we find when they get here. They are proud as a group. They're individuals that violate this, but they're the exception that proves the rule, actually. They are proud and they are arrogant. They have never accomplished anything. They have never done anything, but they think they know more than anybody else. They despise anybody that does not agree with them or that puts pressure on them. We find that these interns, college students, actually despise their parents who are funding because of their work ethic. They're like, my parents don't care anything about ministry, and they're not trying to save the world, and they don't get the fact that kids are starving in Africa, and they look down on their parents for not being involved in social justice while their parents are funding their internship, while their parents are buying the books that they're reading about social justice, while their parents are funding the education that's teaching them how they're going to go out and change the world when they've actually never actually done anything, never proven themselves, not one bit. Never accomplished anything, never solved anything, never helped anybody. They have studied. It is a fascinating reality that caught us off guard. So here's what you have. You have a generation of folks who are arrogant when it comes to things that they know nothing about, only intellectually but not experientially. They're very arrogant. And when it comes time to meet a real task, a real challenge, they have zero confidence, legitimate confidence. Accelerated, inflated arrogance over here and very minimal confidence because they've never had legitimate confidence built through doing things and accomplishing and being a part of something, but they've been inflated over here because of their knowledge. And so we need a little humility over here because we're at the front end of life. We're like 19. We don't really know that much. Need a little humility over here. Need some legitimate confidence over here. George Bush, 41, wrote a book after he was out of office called All the Best. And it's a compilation of his letters for, 50 years, and more than 50 years. And they pulled them from all over the world, people he had written to, ambassadors. And it is absolutely fascinating. It's 500 pages of his letters. It's really a great read. But you'll read in there he writes to his mom a lot. So one of the letters he writes to his, and it kind of caught me off guard. I was like, man, he writes to his mommy all the time, right? His mommy. And I know he's a stud dude, you keep reading. This is one letter. He's like, Mom, yesterday I landed a plane, which he's already a pilot. So he's 22, right? He's already a pilot, landed a plane. He goes, I landed a plane for the first time. I was like, oh, for the first time, because I knew he was a pilot. So I don't know what he's talking about now. I landed a plane yesterday for the first time on an aircraft carrier, which is, as you get to understand the context, in the Pacific during World War II. Now, that's a letter to write home. Is that we have a 22-year-old who's landing planes on an aircraft carrier in the Pacific in a theater of war in a world war against the Japanese. So here's a man who has now, when he gets out, you're like, hey, what can you do? Well, I don't know, anything. He has legitimate confidence because he's actually done something, been a part of something, right? And so when you engage him, when you see him, I mean, there's a genuine spirit of humility. This will be more the idea of putting pressure on the next generation to be able to learn and grow in humility, but actual genuine confidence, which I'm arguing comes through work. And here's why. Because the key to spiritual growth and emotional growth and emotional health, the key is humility, right? And humility comes from what? First Peter. Holiness, humility come from suffering. Now, my oldest daughter has had diabetes for 12 years. You would never wish that on one of your children. But that affliction has humbled her and has brought about things in her character that you can't produce any other way. Now, we would never wish that on our children or anybody, right? Any kind of suffering. But the fact is that work is a legitimate form of mild suffering that brings about genuine humility and confidence. There's accomplishment that happens, and there's humility that happens. What we have is a generation of people who are good at video games. So they think they're good at something. They've never done anything. They don't, and when they face a real challenge, they don't have real confidence to meet it. They have this inflated ego, which gets crushed very quickly when they face something that's really challenging. And so, get this. You will not be able to send your 16-year-old to a camp in the summer to learn more Bible study or send them to church to be a part of a small group at 17 years old or 15 years old so they can now get holy by learning the Bible. The Bible is critical to our spiritual growth, but spiritual values are not received in an arrogant heart. It has to be a humble heart. So how we work humbles us. It makes us more receptive to spiritual things. I was working with a young group of guys a few years ago. And for one of the guys, he's talented. He'd made some money doing something. And we added up how much money he had made that week. And it was 50 bucks, 60 bucks. And I said, let's stretch that out. Let's see what of your life can you pay for with that 50 bucks? And when you get down to it, we can't even pay for his shoes with that. I said, so you worked how many hours? You worked all these hours. And you can't even pay for your own shoes. We're not talking about your house, your bedspread, your bathroom, soap, shampoo, your ability to get back and forth to school, your backpack. We're not talking about your insurance. We're not talking about any of that, right? I said, now how powerful is your dad? Because not only does he pay for all that stuff for himself, he pays for all that stuff for his wife, your mom. He pays for your brother. He pays for you, and he pays for your sister. And so when a 12-year-old boy gets clear on that, he does not hate his dad. He honors his dad. He does not look down on his dad as being weak and mealy. He sees his dad as powerful. He's like, I can't even do what my dad can do. Like, we may not agree on everything. We may have different personalities. I mean, I may not understand everything's going on, but that joker brings it home. He gets it done. Right? I mean, there's a genuine humility that can be formed there. And the confidence piece, it is important as anything that we do, is that we get genuine humility, genuine confidence. I grew up in a home, and I think I shared this on the first week, where work was the highest value. And my dad and I have very different personalities. We got into a major conflict one day, and I got fired, as we now tell the story. And so he said, you're going to go get you a job somewhere else. I was like, that's right, I am going to get me a job somewhere else. So I knew another contractor in the area, so I drove straight to his house. And he opened the door. He happened to be home. He opened the door. And I said, Mr. Bomley, I said, do you need any help, any work? I work construction and worked in a hardware store. I named some things I could do. I said, I'd love to work for you. He said, well, you know, I do need some help. He goes, but I can only pay $5 an hour. And I thought, oh, Jesus, I'm going to be the wealthiest person in the world. I mean, $5 an hour. I was like, I've been liberated from the camp of the oppressed. And he goes, he said, what can you do? And I said, and I really meant it. I did not realize, you know, when you're 16, how the words come out. I said, I can't think of anything I can't do. Right? He goes, can you paint that fascia board? I was like, oh, yes, sir. And he named about five things like that. And he goes, can you stain these doors? I was like, yes, sir. And so I started Monday morning and all that. And I really meant it. I didn't know how to say it. But I had already been exposed to all those things. And I had no doubt that I could do it. And it wasn't trying to be arrogant. It was just legitimate. I'd already been down that road. Now, we don't all own construction companies and put our children to work in that way. We got to find creative ways to teach work ethic. The different skills don't matter. You may be a farmer. You live in a subdivision. You got to be creative. Find other ways to put your sons and daughters to work. But it's the work ethic piece that I'm humble enough to learn. You can tell me what to do. I'll do exactly what you say. I'll get here when you say. I'll finish the job. I won't leave till it's finished. Those kinds of work ethic ideas are very important. Let me say this too. Your daughters are included. This is not just for sons. Princesses included. Once again, I know more about Disney than any of you put together. And there are times when we are princesses. We got dress-up clothes you wouldn't believe. And we can be Cinderella, we can be Sleeping Beauty, we can be all that. There's a time and a place for that. But there's also a time and place where we're going to wash these dishes. I need you to get those bushes and haul them up to the burn pile. All right? You need you to take out the trash right now. I need you to clean that toilet. All right, these are chores that you do. You can gather those leaves. You can cut grass. Your hands are not too precious to smell like gas. And there's no reason that our daughters should grow up and have to put the burden on our son-in-laws to teach them how to partner. When son-in-laws, that's not the job of a son-in-law, is to teach his wife how to partner and how to lend strength and how to come alongside. That's our job. Because we have the moral authority, we have the leadership capital to be able to do that for future sons-in-laws. That's a contribution that we make to them. We teach them how to partner with us and come alongside. All right, let me give you a word. When we think about communicating to our sons, and I'm going to say we got some guys sitting here, so I'm speaking to you. Let me give you a few things. Is that you need to see value in the school work that you do. Right now, the school that you are in, the school work that you do, that is your work. And you need to see it as that. And you need to see value in it. And I'm going to give you three reasons. We can give you 30, but I'm going to give you three good reasons why. So this is something, dads, we communicate for our young men. This is for you. Is that in this culture, education is the number one path to making a living. When you do the statistics and you see the higher you go in education, the more money you make. You go, oh, so it's all about money. No, it's about surviving. Is that money is hard to come by and education helps you make enough to be a provider. And let me just say it real explicitly. Is that when you make enough money to provide, you are attractive to a woman who you can marry and have sex with her and she will respect you. Have your attention now, right? That, you go, well, I'm not worried about that. Oh, you will be. I think you are, but you really will be. Providing opens up all kinds of doors that'll be meaningful to you for the rest of your life. And education helps you get there. Second idea is that the situation you're in school, you are learning how to bear a burden. It doesn't matter what the burden is. You are learning how to bear the burden. And when you bear the burden, your character is shaped. And you are suffering to a degree by being at school and learning how to be excellent at something, learning how to make peace with something that you don't particularly enjoy. And every man in the room can say, that is the rest of your life. Learning how to excel and make peace at something you don't particularly enjoy. Lamentations 3 says this. I think we have a slide for it. It is good for a man to bear the yoke while he is young. It is good for you to suffer and carry a burden and learn how to be humbled by that burden, learn how to make peace with that burden, learn how to excel under that burden while you are young. It will put you ahead as you get older. Jesus said, be faithful in little things, I'll make you master over big things. And so that has these big spiritual, eternal implications, but it also has practical implications right now. Is that you be faithful in something like school that's not that meaningful to you? Burn your energy on things that may not be that meaningful to you now. You learn how to be faithful now. There's more later. Third idea. There is a beauty to obscurity. And that's where you are. You're in school. You're in school with the masses. Right? And so you are obscure. Like David. When the prophet comes to David's house looking for a king and the dad lines up all the brothers, the prophet says, are these all your sons? And he goes, well, it's most of them. It's the good ones, the ones you would want. And the prophet goes, none of these are. Because dad has left David in the field because obviously David's not going to be the king. Obviously not. And the prophet goes, go get him. We'll just sit and wait. I want to see him. David has been laboring in obscurity. No one knows where he is. No one cares where he is. He is working in obscurity. The one person who knows where he is and cares about his future is not even his dad at this moment. It's God himself. God sees those who labor in obscurity. Psalm 37:3 says this. Trust in the Lord and do what is right. Settle in the land, dwell in the land, and cultivate faithfulness. Just like you would cultivate a field, he goes, there's faithfulness that you would cultivate. In other words, you just go into obscurity and you be faithful knowing that God sees you, that he watches you. And there were lots of days. I was living in Dallas and I was in seminary and all my friends were interns at big churches and working on their resumes. And I had stumbled into an opportunity where we cleaned windows, started a little business to clean windows on really nice homes, made way too much money to do that, but it paid for seminary and freed me up to study. And there were days, though, when I would be on the side of a house on the second story, holding on to a ladder with my squeegee in my hand, and I would look as far as I could see houses and no people. And then I'd look as far as I could see houses and no people. And I would think, what does this have to do with planting a church, with doing ministry? What in the world am I doing? And I would think to myself, well, the very least I'm doing, I'm making $40 an hour. And that would bring peace to my soul, all right? And then I would think, I don't know. And then this verse comes out, dwell in the land, cultivate faithfulness. This is what I have to do right now. I'm in obscurity. If God doesn't know I'm here, I'm doomed anyway. But if God knows I'm here, what difference does it make? I'll just do this until he gives me something else to do. And sure enough, he gave me something else to do. And so provided for school, trust in him. The beauty of obscurity is that you trust him when no one's looking and he shapes your heart, he shapes your soul. And now I would look at it and go, that experience had everything to do with what I do now. That experience, it's not like it's somewhat tethered, like a dotted line. It is a hard line between what I did then and what I do now. It is completely connected. All right, and then this last category. You need to find work that is outside of school. You need to. It's not going to be much because you got school, you got other things on you. But you need to find, if you are a young man, you need to find some work that's outside of school. Now, not ministry, not a mission trip, right? Not serving at church, which is a great thing to do, and we talk about it all the time. But someone who pays you for the value that you bring to them. And then you find out the hard lesson, that they don't value what you bring very much, which raises all kinds of huge questions that you got to deal with. Second idea. Is that when you are working outside of your school context, you are beginning to explore and figure out what you can do and what you want to do. This was a great blessing of my home. My dad put me in 1,000 positions that then I could check it off at the end of the day and go, yep, not doing that. I know what I'm not doing for a living, that. And I'd move on to the next thing. I broke my arm my senior year in high school and I thought, you know what the world needs? The world needs a new fast food chain. And I got an idea. So I went to Arby's to get a job, and they said, no, you have no restaurant experience. So I didn't get a job at Arby's, which is why I don't eat there today. And then I went to Bojangles. And Bojangles said, we'd love to have you. So I worked about 4 or 5 months at Bojangles and realized the world does not need another fast food chain started by me. That is miserable work, right? But being in that experience, you go, okay, this is what this is. Do I want to lead this? Do I want to work here? Do I want to be a part of this? You go explore and find out. Third idea. When you find work outside of school, then you get to start experiencing the meaning, the blessing, and the challenge, even the curse sometimes of work. You find out, what does it mean to be a blessing to other people through my work? You will learn, just like we talked about the very first week, you learn how to make a little bit of money and learn how to give that money away. Give some. 10%, 15%, you give some, whatever. And then you learn how to hone a skill. Something that you're good at, you hone that skill. And let me end with this. Ecclesiastes 2:24. There's some interesting words that appear here. There's nothing better for people to do than eat and drink and find enjoyment in their work. I also perceive that this ability to find enjoyment comes from God. Let me show three words that are right there. The idea of work, enjoyment, and God. Those three words. I think that is fascinating. Is that you got work you got to deal with? And how do you find enjoyment in your work and outside of your work? And that to be able to do that is something that comes from God. Right? So a lot of us thought a few weeks ago that work's over here and God's over here. Work's over here and life is over here. It is much more complicated than that. Is that your work is a spiritual thing that God is all involved in. All right, let's pray. Father, we pray that you would give us some more time now together. Move us in ways that we are not prepared to move on our own. Open our eyes to things that we are not prepared to see or don't have the gifts and the ability to see. Father, you do a work in our hearts that will ultimately be noticeable in this world, to our families, to our friends, that you would take one or two things that we have talked about here that become meaningful and press them down into us that would bear fruit. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.